Welcome to the Hadavar Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hadavar Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now let's begin lesson number 9. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Well, let's pick up our class again with lesson number 9. And as we finished up lesson number 8, we were looking at the Pasfield White Paper in 1930. In May, the British government dispatched Sir John Hope Simpson to Palestine. He spent 3 months traveling and investigating the territory, and then he issued a 185-page report on October 20th, 1930, and that really did a lot of criticism, had a lot of criticism of the Zionist hopes and claims. He concluded that the land available to Arabs was less than it was believed. He felt that there should be measures taken to restrict Jewish immigration and land purchases. And on October 20th, 1930, the day that the Hope Simpson report was published, there was also an official statement made in the form of a 23-page white paper issued by Lord Pasfield. And this document skewered Zionist hope for the future. It said that immigration by Jewish people should be suspended, and it seemed to repudiate the very, very purpose itself of the Balfour Declaration, and it seemed to repudiate the terms of the San Remo mandate, the San Remo Award. This Pasfield White Paper foreshadowed serious immigration restrictions and threatened the Jewish community with an embargo on any additional purchases of land. But most significantly, it commented on the work of the Jewish community in Palestine in disparaging terms. It altogether omitted crediting the Zionists for any benefits that they had conferred upon the country and its people. The Zionists, in other words, were of no positive presence in the land of Palestine. Now, the Arabs in general expressed satisfaction with the document, but of course the Jewish reaction was very, very different. Weizmann was outraged, and he immediately resigned as president of the Jewish agency. And Weizmann's was probably the most temperate, the coolest Zionist reaction. The response of the Jewish world in Palestine, in Britain, in America was infuriation. Jewish people sent letters, petitions, cables of protest. Impassioned newspaper articles were written. Newspaper editorials were written. There was endless individual and collective meetings with British public figures. Some of these criticisms hardly needed to be persuaded that the British government had betrayed a solemn trust. It was very, very clear that the British government had gone back on its word. Stanley Baldwin and the Conservative Party promptly disassociated themselves with the Pasfield White Paper. Leopold Amory and Winston Churchill criticized the document in the House of Commons, anathemized the document, probably be a better term. And in a parliamentary debate that ensued on November 17th, Lloyd George accused MacDonald of breaking the word of England. Well, MacDonald, to say the least, was shaken by the intensity of the attack upon him and the break and schisms that it created even in his own Labour Party. The Prime Minister MacDonald, invited Weizmann to lunch on November 6th. Years later, Weizmann's widow published her husband's account of the meeting. The Prime Minister acknowledged errors in his white paper, and he stated, quote, "The errors have to be put right and the misunderstandings to be cleared up, and any new statement is to be issued in agreement with you, but we simply cannot withdraw the white paper." This was just a face-saving device for MacDonald. So in 1931, MacDonald issued his letter. The agreed-on face-saving device for the policy shift was this letter to Weizmann on February 13, 1931. And McDonald's letter significantly reinterpreted the Passfield White Paper. In effect, the document was a reversal. In McDonald's summary, he stated that the obligation laid upon the mandatory was a solemn international promise. And there was no intention at the present, no intention in the past, of disregarding the promises made to the international community. So he immediately backtracked on his position when criticized by the Jewish community. Now, the Passfield White Paper and the McDonald letter revealed British policy, British diplomacy, at its worst. Both documents, the Passfield White Paper and McDonald's letter, both documents convinced first the Arabs and then convinced the Jewish community that sufficient agitation and pressure could reverse the intentions of the British government in regard to the mandatory responsibilities. In other words, if you're vocal enough or violent enough, you'll get your way with Britain. Well, in 1931, we also had the 17th Zionist Congress, and a very important event in the life of the Haganah, the Irgun Zvi Le'umi, Etzel, was founded due to a split in the Haganah. Now, the Irgun Zvi Le'umi means the National Military Organization, or Etzel for short. It originated in 1931 as Haganah Bet, as Defense Plan B. Haganah Bet, Defense Plan B. It was a faction that broke away from the official but labor-dominated underground Haganah. The policy of the new organization was based squarely on Vladimir Jabotinsky's teachings. They were based squarely on 3 points that Jabotinsky emphasized. Number one, every Jewish person had a right to enter Palestine. That's number one. Every Jewish person had a right to enter Palestine. Secondly, only active retaliation would deter the Arabs from attacking. Only active retaliation would deter the Arabs. And the third cardinal principle that Jabotinsky taught, only Jewish armed force could ensure the Jewish state. Only Jewish armed force could ensure the Jewish state. Now, from the outset, the Jewish agency sternly denounced Etzel. The British countered by mass arrests of suspected members. Until 1939, the activities of this group generally were limited to retaliation against Arab marauders. But after 1939, Etzel engaged in activities against the mandatory government. When World War II broke out, Etzel announced a cessation of anti-British activities and offered its cooperation in the war effort. Then, after World War II, after the war, Etzel received an infusion of new recruits. Many of them were deserters from the Polish army. The newcomers were consumed by recent memories of their kinsmen's fate in Nazi Europe. They had been trained militarily. They were intent upon following an activist policy of resistance. But even with these, the Etzel's ranks only grew to about 2,000 men. Even with these enlarged numbers, Etzel was numbered at about 2,000 activists. Even so, the quality of Etzel's leadership was fanatical. The most famous personality is Menachem Begin. He commanded Etzel during its most violent phase. Menachem Begin was a Polish Jew. He had been arrested in Soviet Lithuania for Zionist activities in 1941 and sentenced to imprisonment in a Siberian labor camp. A year later, he was allowed to enlist in the Polish army. His force was temporarily stationed in Palestine, and so he promptly deserted. He joined Etzel and rose to its command in December of 1943. Etzel was noted for the unshakable discipline of its members and for ruthlessness. They extorted funds from Jewish businessmen and occasionally executed Jewish informers. Their world was entirely conspiratorial. They had a price on their heads. They lived under the threat of hanging or under the threat of long prison terms, so they adopted false names, false identity cards. They moved and hid in one place or another. hiding here, hiding there, moving on. We'll encounter Etzel again when we come to some of their more notable military activities in the years ahead. Let's move now to the year of 1933. Very, very important year for the Jewish community worldwide, because in that year Hitler became the German Chancellor. An anti-Jewish economic boycott was created in Germany, and the first concentration camps were set up. And the result was immigration from Germany. And so in 1933, when Adolf Hitler became the Chancellor, dark shadows began to descend on the Jewish world and on the Zionist cause. The shadows grew darker as he rose higher and higher in prominence. Hitler was very interested in gaining influence in the Muslim world. It was his intention to erode the Allied position in this area. This area, the Muslim world, was widely considered as critical to English and French imperial and defensive power. Now, German diplomats revealed no hesitation whatever, in publishing the Nazi anti-Jewish campaign. Upon introducing the Nuremberg racial laws in 1935, Hitler received telegrams of congratulation and praise from all corners of the Arab world. And as the tempo of persecution mounted in Germany, Jewish immigration to Palestine and other lands grew in a like manner. And Germany was hardly alone experiencing emigration by Jewish community. Tens of thousands of Jewish people were leaving Europe. Government-sponsored anti-Semitism was a fact of life in the states of Eastern Europe. In 1939, 275,000 Jewish people fled the Third Reich, and approximately the same amount of Polish, Hungarian, and Romanian Jews departed from their countries as well. So in 1939, 275,000 Jews from Germany alone, another 275,000 from the countries of Poland, Hungary, and Romania. The Fifth Aliyah began at this time as well. Between 1932 and 1935, the Jewish population of the Yishuv doubled. It doubled from 185,000 to 375,000. The new group into the Yishuv was the Central European group, and they had quite a bit of culture, quite a bit of skills, and they brought capital imports with them. And so they set their own unique imprint on the Fifth Aliyah. Now, the most extensive impact of the Fifth Aliyah would be the development of larger Jewish urban centers: Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, Tiberias, Safed. These now underwent what could be called a complete transformation, and these cities now began looking like and taking on the aspect of modern cities. This urban progress in turn reflected a dramatic infusion of German Jewish funds. German Jewish newcomers brought with them millions in imported capital, and they invested the capital in commerce and industry, and these funds launched significant economic expansion, notably metal trades, textiles, and chemicals. So by the mid-1930s, trade and new sea and air routes were opening in Europe. New sea and air routes were opening in Asia. So there was a tremendous amount of optimism for the Yishuv's economic future. The economic future appeared solidly based. In 1935, there was the 19th Zionist Congress, and the Nuremberg Laws were passed. 1936, the World Jewish Congress is founded, and we encounter more Arab riots and a strike in the Yishuv. It was the unprecedented Jewish immigration of the Fifth Aliyah that provided fuel for the fires of Arab revolt. By 1936, Arab fear and hatred had assumed uncontrollable dimensions. Their fear and hatred was inflamed by German and Italian propaganda, and also by religious prejudice from the Mufti of Jerusalem's partisans. The Palestine Arab press warned that the British were introducing Jews into the country, quote, to push the Arabs into the sea and finish them. And the Palestine Arab press said that the Zionists were being incited to kill the Arabs and to attack and torture Arab women and to defile mosques. All statements designed to incite violence. The first acts of violence occurred in a spontaneous and unrelated way during April of 1936. On April 25th, the Mufti introduced several of Palestine's Klan leaders, several of Palestine's Klan leaders to establish an Arab higher committee with himself as the president. The initial outburst of Arab violence was then followed by a mass strike against the government's immigration policy, and the strike was destined to endure for nearly 7 months. The strike was enforced by the Mufti's strong-arm men, and the work stoppage paralyzed government and transportation services, as well as Arab businesses and much of Arab agriculture. But ironically, one of its most decisive effects was to stimulate the Jewish side of things, the Jewish economy. For the first time, large numbers of Jewish workers supplanted cheaper Arab labor. New labor, Jewish labor, came into the citrus groves, and Jewish produce replaced Arab fruit and vegetables in the marketplaces. And on the other hand, the cost of the strike to the Arabs became more and more punitive, increasingly difficult. By midsummer of 1936, the intensity of the fighting mounted as Arab irregulars poured into the hill country around Jerusalem, into Galilee, and into Samaria. A majority of them, at first, were local Palestinians, recruited by Hajj Amin's agents. But soon, committees for the defense of Palestine were established in neighboring Arab lands. Syrian and Iraqi volunteers began arriving in Palestine at the rate of 200 or 300 a month. The leader was a man named Fazi al-Kawukji. He played a vital role in the ensuing civil war. He openly imitated his hero, Adolf Hitler. Now, during the summer of 1936, it was Kawukji who organized military training among the Arab nationalists. He imposed a single unified command over the disorganized rebel forces, and he helped smuggle in Axis weapons. His guerrilla technique rarely varied. It took the form of night assaults on Jewish farms. It took the form of destruction of cattle and crops, the murder of civilians. Armed rebellion soon became a tactic of desperation for the Mufti, as the strike's most crippling effects were experienced mainly by the local Arabs. In July of 1936, the Iraqi government persuaded the Arab Higher Committee to negotiate an end to the uprising. By then, some 20,000 British troops were stationed in Palestine, and 10,000 more were on the way. The High Commissioner allowed it to be known that if the fighting and strike came to an end, a Royal Commission of Inquiry would be dispatched to Palestine, and the Arab Higher Committee might then present its complaints in the appropriate diplomatic circles. And the offer was accepted. On October 11th, the Arab Higher Committee called off the strike, and work resumed the next day. The guerrilla bands had been severely mauled by the British Army, and they were permitted to leave Palestine quietly. Fazi al-Kawukji departed for Transjordan, and the organized violence, slowly died out. By then, some 1,300 casualties had been incurred throughout the country. 197 Arabs had been killed, 80 Jewish people had been killed, 28 British personnel had been killed. Now we come to 1937, and the Peel Commission with its proposal to partition Israel. On November 11th, 1936, the Royal Commission of Inquiry that had been promised arrived. Very end of 1936. Its instructions were to determine the fundamental cause of the unrest, number one, to explore Arab and Jewish grievances, number two, and to make recommendations for the future. We've seen all this before, haven't we? British Royal Commissions to try to find out what's the problem over and over and over again. Well, the chairman of this particular commission was Lord Robert Peel. Now, the Zionists were hardly delighted to have their national home reevaluated by yet another royal commission, but they agreed to cooperate. In their testimony, not one of the Arab spokesmen, when the Arabs testified, not one of their spokesmen found any redeeming qualities of any kind in the Jewish national home. They denied that the British mandate or Jewish economic growth had brought anything other than grief to their people. Weizmann testified at the 51st meeting of the commission. This meeting was held in Jerusalem on January 8, 1937. And it was at this meeting, during Weizmann's testimony, that the notion of partitioning the country was first broached. After 5 months of preparation, the Royal Commission report was issued in July of 1937. The only feasible solution, the report concluded, was to divide Palestine into two self-governing communities. And remember now, Palestine is now simply the land on the west side of the Jordan. The east side of the Jordan was now called Transjordan and was an Arab government. And so the Palestine that's going to be divided up here is a much smaller area than had ever been envisioned in the Balfour Declaration. The reports proposed that Palestine be divided into three regions. Number one, a Jewish state comprising essentially the coastal plain and Galilee. So a Jewish state encompassing the northern part of the land and the coastal plain. Then a much larger Arab state embracing the rest of Palestine and Transjordan, and flow into Transjordan. And thirdly, they recommended a permanently mandated British enclave in the Jerusalem-Bethlehem areas with a corridor to the sea. So a Jewish state, that was basically the Galilee and the coastal plain, an Arab state embracing what was left, and Transjordan, which was the east side of the Jordan, and then a British enclave in the Jerusalem-Bethlehem area with a corridor to the sea. This proposal was so revolutionary, it left most observers stunned. Even more astonishing than this radical plan itself was the speed with which the British government accepted it. Simultaneously with the publication of the Peel Report on July 7th, 1939, London announced its commitment to the recommendations. London announced a commitment to a blueprint for partition as the best and most hopeful solution to the deadlock. Well, the Arabs, the Mufti and his followers, rejected the plan with contempt, and that ensured that the Arab Higher Commission that had been formed, the Arab Higher Committee, turned it down. Jewish reaction was slow in coming. The Zionist Congress assembled a month after the Peel Report was issued. And eventually, the Congress passed a resolution withholding overt approval of the Peel scheme, but empowering the Jewish agency to explore with London the precise terms upon which a Jewish state might be created. At this time, the Arab alternative of alliance with the Axis powers rather than the Allies was systematically being encouraged by Rome and Berlin. Rome and Berlin, Italy and Germany, were both wooing the Arabs, trying to woo them into alliance with themselves rather than with the Allies. Throughout 1937, the Palestine issue opened new opportunities for Nazi activity in the Middle East. And so German funds and German military equipment began to flow to the Arabs. By mid-October, violence ensued, and the violence surpassed the level of the previous year. The violence raged throughout the land of Palestine. There were attacks on Jewish settlements and buses, and the murder of Jewish civilians. For the very first time, British patrols were also attacked and cut down by snipers. July to November 1938 was the fiercest time of the fighting. And during that time, approximately 16,000 local and imported guerrillas were engaged in the insurrection. They succeeded in almost completely paralyzing civil authority outside the nation's larger cities and in the Jewish agricultural areas. By mid-October, the rebels virtually had taken control of the old city of Jerusalem. but this was the high point of the uprising. By the end of the year, some 20,000 British troops were launched on a campaign that was hardly less than a second military occupation of Palestine. And even with these heavy troop concentrations, Britain barely managed to restore a semblance of order in the northern and central districts of the country. This fighting among Jews, Arabs, and the British ultimately claimed several thousand lives and inflicted millions of dollars in property damage. After the issuance of the Peel Report, the Jewish Agency was convinced that the partition of Palestine was imminent. It was certain, too, they were convinced also that the boundaries of any future Jewish state would be determined by the practical evidence of Jewish habitation. Accordingly, land was now to be purchased on the borders of Palestine, especially in western Galilee, and this land was to be matched by immediate settlement. In order to provide protection for the young kibbutz members, a tower and stockade method of settlement was devised. The emphasis was placed on prefabricated construction. Everything was prepared beforehand. And what at daybreak was an empty patch of ground by nightfall would be covered with a solid encampment protected by an outer stockade and a wooden tower with a searchlight. So the kibbutz members would move in, and they would have this little encampment put up in just a few hours. There was little concern for economic viability. This was a crash program of settlement. Get facts on the ground. Get settlements on the ground. Because when the land is divided, they thought, this will be one way we can claim the land. So the most urgent priority during the late 1930s was simply to achieve a Jewish foothold, even if it was just the barest nucleus of pioneers. Establish a Jewish foothold in the outlying regions of the country. Now we come to 1938. It was the Arab uprising in 1936 to 1939, it lasted 3 years, from 1936 to 1939, that drove the Jewish community to take up the posture of active defense. Yitzhak Sadeh, the Haganah field commander, pioneered the concept. And in addition, you'll recall, the mandatory government, hard-pressed for military manpower at this time, authorized the existence of 3,000 gafirs. The gafirs were a uniformed Jewish auxiliary guards. And remember we talked about this man earlier? Even more significantly, the man appointed by the British as operating commander of the gafirs was Captain Ord Wingate. And he vigorously and imaginatively enlarged on Yitzhak Sadeh's concept of active defense. Captain Ord Wingate was a Bible-believing Protestant. He was a passionate adherent to the Zionist cause. He told his closest Jewish friend, David HaCohen, quote, "I count it my privilege to help you fight your battle. To that purpose I want to devote my life. I believe that the very existence of mankind is justified when it is based on the moral foundations of the Bible." End quote. So he was God's man for the hour. With official approval, Wingate was able to innovate a technique even more aggressive than that employed by Yitzhak Sadeh's semi-legal Haganah units. The young Scottish officer was a great leader. His leadership, his resourcefulness, his tactical adaptability on the field evoked admiration from his Jewish troops. In addition, his method of exploiting the night, his ability to use every trick of decoy and feint to carry out audacious surprise raids against guerrilla hideouts evoked the admiration of his Jewish followers as well. Indeed, Wingate's conception of active defense went so far as to include crossings into Lebanon, crossings into Syria, and attacks on guerrilla villages there. Throughout 1938, during their scores and scores of forays and ambushes, the Jewish special night squads inflicted heavy casualties on the Mufti's rebels, and he kept them off balance and increasingly ineffective. Wingate himself was considered expendable. His pro-Zionist views became an embarrassment to the government. Eventually, in the spring of 1939, he was sent back to England, and his superiors wrote this in his file: "A good soldier but a poor security risk, not to be trusted. The interests of the Jews are more important to him than those of his own country. He must not be allowed to return to Palestine. Accordingly, on the front page of his passport were written the words, "The holder of this passport is not allowed to enter Palestine or Transjordan." Wingate ultimately wanted to lead a Jewish army into battle against her enemies, but he never got his wish. He rose to the rank of Brigadier General, and Brigadier General Ord Wingate was killed in a plane crash while fighting in the jungles of Burma during World War II in 1944. However, he had done his job, and the Haganah's ability to cope with the rebellion was infused with a new confidence, and this confidence created hope and confidence in the Jewish population as well. Now we come to the Woodhead Report, the report of the Palestine Partition Commission. It was in reaction to the mounting Arab violence in Palestine that London announced the impending visit of what? A yet another commission. This one was sent to determine methods by which partition might be carried out. They were sent to recommend boundaries for the proposed Arab and Jewish states. The commission chairman was Sir John Woodhead. Sir John Woodhead. On November 10th, 1938, the Palestine Partition Commission report, the Woodhead Report, was submitted to Parliament. It declared the Peel Partition Plan unfeasible. Predictably, the Zionists were enraged by the Woodhead Report. The Arabs were less critical of the plan, but they rejected it on grounds that it still envisioned Jewish sovereignty, even if this sovereignty was in a diluted form. On November 26, 1938, yet another white paper was issued, this one formally rejecting as impractical any notion of dividing Palestine. The statement resorted instead to the familiar observation that the surest foundation of peace and prosperity in Palestine would be an understanding between the Jews and the Arabs. To that end, the government announced its intention of inviting representatives of the Zionists, of the Palestinian Arabs, and of the neighboring Arab states to a conference in London. If negotiations did not produce an agreement within a limited time, the government would make a policy decision itself, and they would enforce it with or without Arab or Jewish cooperation. These talks would be known as the London Round Table Conference. So after the initial phase of the uprising in 1936 to 1937, London had admitted that the Palestine Mandate was unworkable, and this was the claim that Arab nationalists had advanced from the start. So now the second phase of the Arab Rebellion was followed by abandonment of the partition plan well before any effort could be made to put it into operation. The Arabs had plainly mastered a very crucial lesson, and the lesson was this: violence on behalf of their rights in the Holy Land was effective diplomacy with Britain. If you didn't get what you want, riot, and it'll work. Also in 1938, as we look at Europe, we note that Kristallnacht occurred, and it produced economic ruin for the Jews in Germany. As we move to 1939, we come to the beginning of World War II and the London Roundtable Conference itself. The London Roundtable Conference opened on February 7th, 1939 in St. James Palace. The Arabs refused to sit in the same room with the Jews, and so arrangements were made for the two delegations to enter the palace by separate entrances. And so what happened, therefore, was essentially two parallel conferences, private meetings with the two groups. In a private meeting with the Zionists, Colonial Secretary MacDonald asserted frankly that Britain's lifeline to the Middle East largely depended upon the sympathetic understanding of the Arab world. Notice, the lifeline. The lifeline was oil and the Suez Canal. And now we begin to see the reasons why Britain began to waffle on the mandate. She felt her lifeline depended on a sympathetic relationship with the Arab world. And he stated that with war imminent, World War II looming over the horizon, he stated that His Majesty's government was left with no choice but to ensure that the Arab governments were not tempted to accept support from hostile powers, from Germany and Italy. So, if it came to a choice between Arab and Jewish support, MacDonald said, Jewish help, however valuable, represented no compensation to Britain for the loss of Arab and Muslim goodwill. And the key Arab demand remained unchanged, termination of the mandate. They wanted the mandate terminated and the award of independence to Palestine to be the form of an Arab-dominated state. And the British now agreed to this demand in principle. It was agreed that it was a demand that was agreed to for expediency. On May 17, 1939, London issued the MacDonald White Paper. His Majesty's government had decided to establish a quota of 10,000 Jewish immigrants for each of the next 5 years, plus another 25,000 refugees. After a period of 5 years and a total of 75,000 immigrants, no further Jewish immigration would be permitted without Arab permission. In addition, the sale of lands to the Jewish community was prohibited immediately. The declaration of British policy. This declaration of British policy was a foreclosure on any subsequent growth for the Jewish national home. It sealed off Palestine as a haven for all but an insignificant fraction of Jewish refugees. And it did this at a moment when European Jewry was faced with a mortal threat to its physical survival. What did the Arab Higher Committee do? Did they like that? Did they like the radical nature of this policy? No. The Arab Higher Committee chose to denounce the White Paper. They denounced it on the grounds of too much immigration. Well, the Zionists did the same thing. The Zionist response was to denounce the White Paper, too, for too little immigration. On May 18th, the day after the White Paper was issued, the Jews of Palestine conducted demonstrations throughout the country. They furiously denounced the White Paper in synagogues and in public meetings. Isolated riots broke out. A policeman was killed. The revisionist paramilitary organization, the Irgun Zvei Leumi, bombed a number of government buildings in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and sabotaged rail lines. In Britain itself, the White Paper met with serious criticism on all sides. No criticism was as harsh as Churchill's. Here's a short quote from Winston Churchill's assessment. This pledge, and I quote here now, this pledge of a home of refugees, of an asylum, was not made to the Jews of Palestine, but to the Jews outside Palestine, to that vast, unhappy mass of scattered, persecuted, wandering Jews whose intense, unchanging, unconquerable desire has been for a national home. That is the pledge which was given. That is the pledge which we are now asked to break. End quote. Well, Churchill had a correct understanding of what Zionism is, didn't he? He said that Zionism was the intense, unchanging, unconquerable desire for the Jewish national home. He got it right. When the Palestine issue reached a vote in the House of Commons at the end of the month, the cabinet won a slim majority. The Chamberlain government's stringently anti-Zionist interpretation of the mandate required the approval not only of Parliament, however, but also of the League Permanent Mandates Commission, the League of Nations Permanent Mandates Commission. And the members of the commission did not accept the argument. In their report to the League Council, they declared, quote, the policy set out in the White Paper was not in accordance with the interpretation which, in agreement with the mandatory power and the council, the commission had placed upon the Palestine mandate. So this was vindication by the world body. It was of very little consolation to the Jewish community. And at this time, Zionist resistance began to take shape. The Jewish Agency publicly sanctioned and privately organized clandestine immigration. The influx of illegal refugees became unusually heavy in the spring of 1939. Agricultural settlements continued to go up under the cover of darkness. The agency ordered a secret Haganah registration of all men and women between the ages of 18 and 35. Well, for Britain, the White Paper of 1939 appeared to pay off. You see, a major part of the oil resources of the Commonwealth were in the Arab world. The MacDonald White Paper, by and large, succeeded in keeping the Arab world quiet, and that's why it was written. That was its rationale. However, for the Jews, the White Paper of 1939 was likely a death warrant for their people in Europe, and very likely a death warrant for their hopes in Palestine. Well, I see we've run out of time for this lesson. Let's bring this lesson to a close, and we'll pick it up again on lesson number 10.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Heart of Our Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Heart of Our Messianic Ministries. If you're listening to this class on audio tape, please turn the tape over to begin the next lesson. If you're listening to this class on CD, the next lesson will begin in a moment.